As you know, my name is Sam Wilson. I'm a staffer. I work in registration in the store. I just graduated from the University of Minnesota at the Lee with a double major in psychology and communication. And in September, I plan on starting at least a seminary. And I hope to come to chaplaincy work and counseling. And I wanted to talk to you about being handicapped today. And I'm going to share a lot of myself with you only because I want you to understand what it's like. And you can best understand by asking questions. So I hope that you do. If nothing else, probably out of curiosity or clarification. My handicap is cerebral palsy. That's a birth defect. I was born at 6 months and weighed 2.5 pounds. I wasn't expected to live, but my hometown got their first incubator 1.5 weeks early. And that's what helped me survive. And right away from birth, I was a big thing in the newspaper. Every day they found the little frozen baby in the new incubator, that kind of thing. It wasn't discovered that I had cerebral palsy until I was 1.5 years old. And at that time, the doctors suspected that I would be mentally retarded and suggested to my parents to put me in an institution because they didn't think I would amount to very much. That's debatable, I guess. But they decided not to do that, and instead they took me home and they raised me with like my other sisters and brothers. I was the second to 5 children, and they never showed any favoritism or any special treatment on me. The only way that I would think that I was raised differently than my sisters and brothers was that my parents had to spend a lot more time and energy with me, doing a lot of exercises all the time, taking me back and forth to the male clinic. And I always felt that they had to put a lot more money into me than the other kids because I had a lot of surgery. And but other than that, I was just like one of the other kids. They always included me in all the activities and from the very beginning taught me to be independent. That was the best thing to be, to do things for myself, to do what I could. And I don't know when my mother ever exactly said it, but I can, whenever I think back on this, I can remember 2 things that my mother always said. And that there's no such word as can't, and you can do anything if you only try. And for a long time, that developed a lot of determination and persistence in me. I could do anything and I would try. I went to a regular public school through to high school. It took a lot of hard work on my mother's part to get me into public school. They didn't want me to go. I went to kindergarten and first grade on probation to see if I could do it. And then they decided I could. I was always very popular in school, always well-liked, always very successful, very intelligent, always a leader, always included in all the kids' activities, and I made sure that I was. And so, on the outside, I looked like I was just a marvelous person, and that I had accepted my handicap really well, and I was always praised for being so accepting and such an inspiration, and I was always happy and always smiling, and that's the way people wanted me to be, I thought. So I was like that. And for a long time I was happy, but as I grew older, I realized that I wasn't. That smile became what I now call being very sugar-coated. I guess I kind of thought that if I smiled my way through life, everything would be okay. But underneath that sugar coating, there were a lot of cracks and a lot of problems that I had to deal with. I guess there's three different cracks or three different problems that I can identify if I think back on my life. And the first is that I always strive to be perfect. As I said earlier, I felt like my parents had to spend more time and effort and money on me. And I always wanted to make that up to them by being perfect. I felt guilty for them having to spend time with me, and I felt real responsible for that they'd be happy. And so maybe I couldn't do the things that my sisters and brothers could, but I could be a good girl and I could get good grades. Those are two things that I was very good at. So, and I felt in some way, even though they never said that, I felt like they were real sad that I was handicapped. So I wanted to make them happy in one way. Make them happy would be good and be perfect. And they never made a big issue about money, but I remember thinking, going to bed and thinking that someday I was going to make a lot of money to make up for all the money they had to spend on me and all the medical bills and debts and things. And so I felt guilty and responsible for making them happy, so I was going to be perfect. And that was one thing that I can really see working in my life. The second crack underneath all my smiles and achievement was that I have a lot of angry feelings about being handicapped. A lot of times life didn't seem fair and I wanted to do the things that the other kids could do that I just couldn't. But I had nowhere to go with those angry feelings, no one to talk to about them, so I covered them all up underneath smiles. My family never talked about my handicap. It was as though it was never there. We never talked about how I felt about it, how the other kids felt about it, how my parents felt about it. It was just something we never did. But I can remember my handicap being explained to me as a gift from God, and that gifts from God were good, and that I was special in God's eyes. And that was one way it was explained. Whenever I did feel bad about things that I couldn't do or things that I wanted to, any kind of depressed feelings, that was always interpreted as pity, and pity was bad. And I was always told how lucky I was, that I was lucky that I could walk, that I wasn't in a wheelchair, that I wasn't like the other handicapped kids, that I was so lucky that I could walk. Well, that really caused me problems, because a lot of times I didn't feel lucky, but very unlucky. I didn't have the other handicapped kids to look at. The people I looked at always could do things easier and better than I could. I was always at the bottom and they were, and I wanted to do the things they could. And I could never, I didn't think I could be angry with God because God was good. And what right did I have to get angry with God? I thought I loved God, and if I loved him, I wouldn't get angry. And if I was going to be angry, how could God love me? So, and the discrepancy grew as I got older. For, you know, when I was young, it was just that I wanted to walk, and I wanted to run, and I wanted to jump rope and roller skate like all the other kids. And as I grew, the issues got more important to me. I wanted to drive a car, and I wanted to date, and I wanted to have a job like everybody else. And now my mother's statements that there's no such word as can, or you can do anything if you try, they didn't work anymore, because there were things I couldn't do no matter how I tried, and I couldn't change things. But for a long time I never thought about that, because I wasn't supposed to be angry and I was supposed to feel lucky. So I smiled and thought maybe it would all go away. So while I was trying to be perfect and having no place to go with the angry feelings, another part was that I had no sense of identity. Who was I, a handicapped person or a normal person? From the age 8 to 18, I attended a camp for crippled children in Minnesota called Camp Courage. And it's a beautiful camp, and I'll always cherish the experiences I had there, but I remember feeling really confused by being there. For 50 weeks out of the year, I was with normal people, where I was the only handicapped person. And 2 weeks out of the year, I was with all these handicapped people. And I didn't always like being with them, because I didn't always like what I saw. I wasn't like them, really. I didn't feel. Especially as I grew older, it became more of a struggle for me, because as I grew older, I wanted to go to college and get a career and be married and things like that. And I particularly remember the last summer I was there, I was 18, and a lot of these kids were in nursing homes and going to rehabilitation centers. And I didn't want to be like them. I didn't want a future in a nursing home. And so who was I? I remember thinking or wishing that I was either a little bit more normal, so I could be like all the people I knew, or a little more handicapped, so I could be contented and be like those people. And I remember just wrestling with, was I Jan, the girl who happened to be handicapped? Was I Jan, the handicapped girl? Where did my handicap fit into it all? I didn't exactly like being handicapped, but then I couldn't say I wasn't, because I was. I was different than all the people out there that I was with, that I was trying to be part of. And that just got really, really mixed up. But I was able to be the happy, go lucky, smile, and you'll get through life person until I got to college. That's when things kind of were my own to define, and I really had to come to grips with who I was and things, and that was a real crisis time. I became very depressed, very withdrawn, very sad, very passive, very dependent. I remember thinking, well, if that's how people want me to be, then I'll be that way. I just kind of gave in to being handicapped. It was too much of a struggle to try to be normal and deny that I was handicapped. So I let people do for me more than they needed to. I found that that's how I got a lot of acceptance, with a lot of people liked to mother me and liked to help me. And people felt sorry for me, so I let them feel sorry for me. And during that time, I became anorexic. And I was diagnosed with having anorexia nervosa. And that's why I was starving myself. I just progressively ate less and less. The more I tried to be perfect, like I had before, the harder it was to be perfect. To always make my parents happy, and be the person I thought they wanted me to be. It was harder to be perfect in God's eyes and not be angry and to try to feel lucky when the future I wanted wasn't the future I saw myself having. And it was harder for me to define who I was when I was confronted with a lot more stereotypes and people that seemed to be saying that I couldn't be that or I shouldn't be that. And so during that time I was depressed and I started abusing laxatives to lose weight, part of the anorexia thing. I would eat boxes of laxatives. I was on prescription Valium and I started abusing that. Whenever things got too hard for me to handle, I would take that one. The night before my 21st birthday, I made a suicide attempt by, I was supposed to take one Valium and I took 20. And by the time I had gotten down 67 pounds, I was in my second treatment center for anorexia. And it was during that second hospitalization that my therapist kept saying, they recognized that I was angry, and they said, it's okay to be angry, Dad. That's okay. You can be angry. You have every right to be angry. Life isn't fair. We understand that. Be angry. And I was there for 3.5 months, and for the first 2 months, I wouldn't be angry. I denied completely that I was angry. No, I couldn't be angry. Who was I to be angry with God? If I got angry, then I was totally unlovable. I was just, that was something that a Christian couldn't be with angry. If I was a Christian, any kind of Christian I thought I wasn't going to get angry. Well, I finally got angry. And it wasn't any violent sort of thing. It was more of just a recognition that I was angry and that I couldn't fight it anymore. More than a recognition, it was more of a resignation. Okay, I give up. I'm angry. And that was the lowest of the low times for me. I just thought God was going to give up on me. I might as well go to hell. Because I wasn't at all who I thought I was. And you might as well forget me because I thought I was a good Christian, but I wasn't because I got angry. Well, during that time, somewhere in that time, my cousin gave me the book, Why Do Christians Break Down? And as I read that book, I just kind of absorbed it. A whole different understanding of God and religion came to me. In this book, the author allowed me to be angry with God. He said that if my relationship with God was real and dynamic and honest and loving, then I could be angry with him. And that God could accept that. And we could grow. And it was just like, hooray, it's okay. And as I read that, I realized that there were other parts of religion that I kind of bought into that weren't true, and I didn't have to carry around that burden anymore. And it was like a whole different life came to me. And during that time in the hospital, I kept a diary because I can write really well, and that's one way for me to get my feelings up. And as I read this book, I just wrote page after page after page of all the fantastic things I was finding out. And through it, I felt reconciled to a God that I knew, a God that with his grace could accept all my human feelings and mistakes, that they were okay. And I guess that's where my living with my handicap is now. I hate to say it because it sounds like something you hear on TV, but it's a real spiritual thing for me. I have a relationship with God where I can confront him with all my angry feelings, all my hurt feelings, all my sad feelings, all the struggle that it takes to live with a handicap, and he can accept it and turn those feelings into strength. And it's in being able to confront God with how I really feel that I can keep going from day to day. And it's not just the angry feelings, but it's the joyous feelings. That's where I feel closest to God is in the struggle to live with a handicap. Part of me is kind of crucified every day as I walk around and try to be the person I want to be. And it's in there that I find strength to keep going. This last semester of school, my next youngest sister, who was a freshman in college this last year, was going to do a term paper on cerebral palsy. And she asked me to write something about what it's like to be handicapped. And I really thought about it a long time because I knew, how could I pull together all these thoughts and feelings into something that she could understand and want to include in her paper. So I really thought about it a long time to come up with kind of a capsule idea. And the idea that I came up with was that it's very much like Kubler-Ross's five stages of death. That my dealing with my handicap is a lot like death, in that it's a sense of loss. And I live with a sense of loss for the person that I'll never get to be. That I'll never get to walk. That I'll never get to do the be like you in a lot of ways. And that's a lot of what a person goes through in death. And Kubler-Ross identified five stages of death. And five stages that she talks about is denial, bargaining, anger, depression, and acceptance. And I can see that working in my life as I live with a handicap, in that some days or some moments I can deny that I'm handicapped and I'm just like you, and I can be Wonder Woman. I can do anything if I try, and don't tell me I can't, because I can and I will. So there's those days and those moments of denying, you know. And then there's the moments of bargaining. God, just take it all away. I don't want it anymore. Take it all away. If I'm, you know, just for a little bit, take it all away. Then some days or some moments of the day, there's the anger. Why me? Why? Why don't people understand? And people will never understand, and I'll never be able to do that. And there's anger. And some days, some moments, there's a real depression. That it's never going to end. Not tomorrow, or not the tomorrow after that, am I going to be able to get up and walk. That there are always going to be people that aren't going to understand. I'm always going to have to do that. That I'm going to be handicapped when I'm 20 and 30 and 40 and 50. And then some days there's a total acceptance of who I am, and I like who I am, and I'm a good person, and I feel unity with God, and I can see the sensitivities that I've got through my handicap. But something that I'm continually learning, even now, is that my acceptance of my handicap is not a state that I once reached and never leave. That it's a daily process of accepting who I am and having God fit into that. That it's a daily thing and not just something that I achieve and will never lose again. So I guess I told you all that there is a lot me to tell.
You don't leave enough pregnant pauses in your speech. You had it too well there for us to jump in. I have a bunch of questions.
So yeah, now you can do whatever you want to with all that.
I had just one information question, and that was that, was the prematureness of your birth, did that have any effect? Could that have been the cause of having cerebral palsy, or was it something else?
I was born so early that during delivery my cranium was damaged. It was just too soft, I guess. So underdeveloped.
Mm-hmm.
That's one part of it that I know. Another thing that's never been explained to me was during my first admission interview for treatment of anorexia, the psychiatrist asked my mom if she had any problems during my pregnancy, and she said she had Asian flu, and that was something I had never known. So I don't know if she was sick more than that. I just part of something I had known someday.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Does cerebral palsy, it does not progress?
No, it's not like that. No,
so you don't have to worry about being unable to, about your muscles deteriorating more or anything?
Not that I know of, no. It's kind of like it's been explained to me that I've reached a plateau in my abilities, but there's not a whole lot more that doctors can do. That this is how I'm going to be. And if I didn't keep working at being this way, I could regress. No. But not, no, it's not like muscular dystrophy where the muscle can do that.
Do you do a certain amount of physical therapy on your own?
No, not more than just getting around like I do. The doctors have always had a fear that I would love to be in a wheelchair, which I don't. But I guess most people do, that, to keep them walk. If you decide not to walk and are in a wheelchair, then you won't be able to walk. It's good. And that's not my problem at all. I don't like
when you make it up to 10-mile falls, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I just can't. That's the equivalent of about a 50-mile hike for me, I think. I'm just amazed.
So amazed. Compared to when I first got here, and I got off that bus. I had just spent so much time and energy getting here by boat and bus and everything and plane and got off that bus and I saw those hills and I thought, oh God, why was I here for this? What am I doing now? But it's gotten a lot better.
Why did you come to Holy Village?
I'm getting my, amazingly enough, I'm getting my last 7 college credits here. And my advisor had just heard of it. And he had been asked to be on faculty, and he said that couldn't fit into his framework of life right then. And he said, I think there'd be some place you'd like. And I was trying to think of something I could do for the summer to get credit. And so I applied. I didn't know much about it. And whenever I would try to explain to somebody what I was doing for my summer, it never came out good and I couldn't answer their questions, so I just started telling people that I was going to Fantasy Island. I get all these letters back from people and they say, how is Fantasy Island? Have you seen Tattoo yet?
What class are you taking there?
I'm just calling it independent study, and I'm gonna be writing a paper on Christian community living and communication stuff.
In your family, are you
able to talk about your handicap now? Do you want your treatment?
They don't talk about it. I talk about it because I need to. When I got out of the hospital after my first treatment for anorexia, I knew that a lot of the conflicts had to deal with my handicap. And on the way home from the hospital that time, I was just talking on. And my mom came right out and said, "Jen, you really shouldn't talk about those things to your father and I. You know, that makes us feel real guilty. Those are the things you're supposed to talk to your therapist about." And I don't know if there must be a grief there or a guilt there that I don't know what's all gone into it, but it's whenever. So they listen to me talk, and one good way for me to do it is I write letters, and that way they don't have to respond. They can read the letter as many times as they want to, or they can throw it away. I don't know what they do, but at least I'm getting it out. And I don't know. So we still don't talk about it. We can talk about it on a very functional level. I've always been able to do that, you know, about my crisis and about my therapies, or, you know, about how hard it is to get around and things like that. And but never on an emotional level. You know, I don't know if it's just too bad or what there is on there.
What are your feelings, or what kind of things, situations, make you most irritated or mad at other people? You think that they aren't where do you get maddest or most irritated at other people when they when you think that you're being mistreated because of your handicap?
A lot of people, because I'm physically handicapped, they assume that I'm mentally tired. And they talk down to me as though I'm a little in a very condescending way. And they talk down to me. And that's so hard for me to deal with, because I just want to scream, I'm not. And that's not isolated. That happens a lot when I face new people. Maybe it comes from the mental part of things. You know, I'm not seeming younger than I am. Maybe it comes out of pity for me. I know that lots of people have those feelings. A lot of protectiveness. I want to take care of me. Not seeing me as an adult. But a lot of people, they want to help, I think, a lot of times for their own self. Something. I don't know what all goes into that, but it makes them feel good to help me. And I don't want to say, to compromise my ability just to make somebody feel good to help me. I respect the offers of help more than if a person is just silent. But don't be angry or disappointed if I don't push you up on it. Instead, rejoice that I want to do it myself.
Would you rather that people would just wait for you to ask for some help?
That shows me that they're aware. It gets hard to always have to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you really have to work hard on your self-esteem to be able to allow people to help you. I need help, and to always
has to be at the asking end of help at times. It takes a lot of feeling good about who I am, being able to day after day after day ask people to help me. I have to know that I need help and that independence comes through help. And all of that. I don't know if you can understand it, but I think a lot of people have trouble asking for help and asking for things. And to be in a position where I have to ask for help, there's a lot of dynamics that go into it.
I see some.
And that's part of the reason why it's so hard every time I go to a new environment. It was real hard to come from college where I could do so many things and stuff, come here, where initially I always have to be more independent and ask for more help. And to have to do that every time I go to a new place to do that. Now it's getting better because I'm more prepared for it. And I can know that sooner or later I'll be able to do more by myself. But
how are you more prepared for it?
Because I know that it has to come. And I've just gone through so much introspection of all these things that I know. Hang on, Jan, because it's not always going to be this way. The more I am in an environment, the more I'm capable I get.
You said you spent 2 weeks within a handicapped program?
Every summer.
What things do you think to be done in the way of like a handicapped program?
I don't know, because while I was in it, I was enjoying it. And I really love camp. I mean, I did go to camp. So I don't know. I wasn't like the other kids because I could do too much for myself. Most of those people went to handicapped school and had always been around handicapped people. It's not a fault of the camp, it's just what I've been into. So, I don't think the camp is just my identity.
Do you have any problems with the word handicap? You know, some people feel very sensitive about the word and others don't.
You don't have preference for disabled.
It doesn't matter to me. I know a lot of people that don't have enough on it. I'm really angry and defensive. I get friends from saying that I'm handicapped. There's another one here that would say, no, I'm not handicapped. I'm not. For me, it's okay. The word doesn't matter to me, it's the understanding. I mean, I don't know what's wrong. I just want to know me. When John suddenly announces this, we got to come up with a different word for this handicap. It didn't matter to me. I guess it all depends on where you want to put the energy. There's so much out there that I can put my energy and put myself towards. I want to put it towards words and what people call me, and I can. To me, there's so much more. There's the understanding underneath or behind it.
Are you left-handed?
Yeah. Can you can tell. My whole left side is stronger. My right hand, I can't do my left hand. So, my left hand
out. I'm not sure everything involved is really important.
Yeah, you're right. It's a brain damage. There's a part of your brain is damaged. Either it can be damaged during your life, like in an accident. But there's a part of your body, so many different symptoms going on because of so many different areas of your brain that can be damaged. Like Susie has cerebral palsy and she can walk, but the center of her brain doesn't have it, is not affected. Some people, their motor coordination is affected more. Some people, it's very highly noticeable. Other people, they're so fast that they can't talk as much. I can't do it for that reason.
Is it a visual affection?
No, but my eyes don't coordinate.
But you see eyes?
Yeah.
I do know that your eyes don't coordinate. You can't focus on anything directly?
No. I can't notice it in my vision, but you can notice it. One eye alone.
I'm just trying to figure out what it's like, but it's like what I do with my eyes. That is that I can't focus on anything directly. I'm pretty much looking through one eye at a time and just a little peripheral vision with the other one. I suppose I don't want to be getting on too much on the news. if you want to ask some more.
I think I'd like to ask you a question.
Oh, good.
Not
good.
You, but where did you find me? I mean, because I need to know for myself. And if you're not ready to tell me,
what do you mean by that?
I mean, you know everything that I know about me now.
Not quite.
Does it mean like a positive thing?
That I don't dream them. I lost everything I did before I dream. I would like to just really get into the
dream. I just never know whether people see the strength behind it, or if it's just the problem, that comes out of the situation. I really think I learned maybe I learned a bit of talking to you.
pandemic, I was working in China. Last summer, I worked with Jim Fisher's brother, Nick, who was a chaplain in Greece. And in Greece, the first conference of his hospital, I called people up on the telephone. To be the 6 months after they had lost someone in the hospital. And all I had going when I called them was the name from the death record. And I didn't know who I was going to talk to or really why the person had died, because I had no one. I just had the base thing in the hospital. And I just said, yeah, I thought, oh, these people are doing that. And like, what's your business calling? And what's that know about someone dying? But I thought that I really didn't understand. And I'm just trying to come from my new college. I come from them and I have a particular ministry. I know I'm a really human being, I guess. And now I'm adopting and I think that was pretty remarkable that I could do that. So that's when, you know, it sounds kind of weird. But I'm not glad that I'm home that I can feel my feelings and be sensitive to them. And that I can, you know, bring them out and keep.
You said that you were able to say that when you did discover that the right story of things, and that a lot of people always try to keep things inside. And so letting them out, there are stories that if they're ugly for a minute, that we remember the ugly ones.
Mm-hmm.
The person handicapped the others and not the ones that but people just have a hard time doing it. It's a hurt feeling to know the thing. You can be there and there's always joy, but the sorrow is in the sorrow. And if only people understood that it's in our cross experiences that's where we can fight. And just be close to what could be of that you don't have to always keep having together. And the positive things can only take on their duty in light of the negative.
The theology of God.
Yeah. And God can accept as a man, but I just think it's all the people in between that I don't know. No, that's it, you know. The more I do it, people, the more I'm just so thrilled at it.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to say a positive word about that book, Translation of
the Scriptures. Oh,
you read it? Oh, yeah. Yeah. I did, because I just did a study on that book. I mean, it was for 2 weeks to study that book. And we had the author come to it, too. Fantastic.
I talked to another guest here that I mentioned on YouTube. I can't remember his name, but he was telling me some things.
He said,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I talk to them, I think I realize it sounds like something you hear on the TV now, call me from the back. And God's testimony is, oh yes, I read this book and God just changed me. Well, okay.
I
didn't
know what I
have
to say. I was having this one in my head, I was like, no, it's not really honest, but I just want to sound really good. Every time I question myself, I know it's honest, because I question myself so much, but it sounds like it's always something you turn on the TV and God, you're really honest. But that's the only
thing. I don't really know what the book is about. What's it about?
It's so long time you know about it, but it's just... Oh, God.
Well, I think it talks about the very thing that you've been mentioning, that every one of us has a dark corner sometimes in our lives. You know, a little phrase we talk about, and
And it was encouraging us to, not feel guilty or bad about having a child.
We all do.
Yeah.
All the truth. Yeah. It's okay to be a friend. Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's okay to be a man. That bad. It's a better.
When I was doing this interaction, I was really afraid to eat and afraid to tell and afraid to go to work. I really tried to reach out to them and pushing people towards that I was in front of them. But I found that the Christian was people that would send me more because they said, well, don't you have faith if you're afraid? Don't you have faith? And have more faith and you won't be afraid and just pray and God will take it all away. But this book said, you can have faith and be afraid too. It's not really the only situation. And you can be angry and others and not feeling less of a Christian. And all the negative things don't make it work.
In fact, if you go to spread that, it would actually be the birthday of them.
Yeah. What is your opportunity? Why do Christians go wrong?
Have you ever felt the need to, you wanted to say to God to have your handicap taken away from you so you could walk again as everyone else? And how has your reaction to that been?
Friends, I thought were friends that took me to a faith room. I got up on the stage in the hunger, and these friends at the Duluth Auditorium, so it was a whole bunch of people, and they took me there not knowing what they were going on. And they told me to go up and they were going to heal me. And I said, no, I didn't want to go, so they carried me up there. And so they carried me on stage and gave me to the ministry. And they played me in the spirit or whatever. And he thought that I couldn't walk at all. Well, I can walk if I hang around your arms. But that's what he did. He had me walk across the stairs, hanging around your arms. And he was praising the Lord that I could walk and let me carry him in. Well, I could do that all the time. I wasn't anything new. I was just understand. Well, now let go of my arms. And I said, no, I'm going to fall. And then he goes, no, don't say that. Say, praise the Lord. Don't say yes to the Spirit. And he goes, yes. And he says, I'm going to fall. But so pretty soon he was losing all the enthusiasm he had for the crowd. He saw the crowd just praise the Lord. And so then he took me off the chair and he said, well, how old are you? And I said, 20 years, and he said, well, the devil's been in me for 20 years. Well, it's going to take a while for it to get out. And all these friends that had brought me, it was a whole bunch of people, and they went up to the person inside and said, well, why can't you really walk? He said that they're going to take a while. I said, no. And this person said that if they all prayed for me within 9 months, I'd be able to walk. And for about 6 months, every morning, I had someone call me and ask me if I could walk. And that doesn't really answer your question, but that was just so hard. No, I never felt that. When that happened, I didn't know
But that's what you want, you know.